Hey everyone, welcome back to The Forum, the official podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy. I'm Daniela.
And Cleo here, Daniela's proud accomplice.
Hey you two, Aubrey's here as well. You didn't think I'd be missing out on the fun, did you? And for those of you listening in, thanks for socializing with science today.
If you at home want to join the conversation, be sure to tweet us your questions, comments, and opinions with @ISGPForum and the hashtag ISGPForum. And you'll find our show on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPForum.
Okay, so now that we've gotten our customary introductions out of the way, let's talk about saving the world. Wait, if we're not too late?
Well, Cleo, I certainly wouldn't say the world is coming to an end, but you might be on the right track when thinking about its health and climate change. Today's podcast will discuss a debate that occurred at one of our climate change-themed conferences, which was held in November 2015 in Toms River, New Jersey.
The Shore's Future, Living with Storms and Sea Level Rise, was the name of the conference.
And the paper in question, titled The Coming Reality of Sea Level Rise Along the New Jersey Coast, Too Fast, Too Soon, was written by Harold Wanlis from the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Miami.
So, as a fellow Floridian like Dr. Wanlis, this debate and his paper really stuck in my mind.
Hey, don't forget about me. I'm also a Florida girl.
Just because you went to university down here does not make you a Florida girl.
All right, calm down, guys. Dr. Wanlis also spent his undergraduate years here in New Jersey at Princeton, like myself. Anyway, whether you're from Florida or New Jersey, one thing is certain. Just like coasts around the world, New Jersey and Florida's beaches are in danger.
She's right. Actually, the most recent National Climate Assessment published by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, projected sea levels to rise between 4.1 and 6.6 feet within the next century.
So could it even rise within the next 50 years, as in within our lifetime?
Well, yeah. Actually, these projections mean that sea level could rise by 2 feet by as early as 2048 and 3 feet by 2063.
And I'm sorry to break it to you, Cleo, but if we let this 2 or 3 foot rise happen, it could make most of the world's barrier islands, like Barnegat Peninsula in my New Jersey neck of the woods, and the low-lying coastal zones like South Florida, very difficult places in which to live, especially with hurricanes and other extreme weather events.
And we all know that Jersey weather can be about as indecisive as I am about what to wear in the morning.
Well, on top of atmospheric mood swings, the serious issue is that most of the models predicting sea level rise only account for a gradual acceleration. In other words, they are based on the idea that Greenland and Antarctic ice will melt gradually. But actually, sea level rise projections should be accounting for what we have seen in the past.
So does that mean that true projections of sea level rise would be higher or lower than those that we just discussed?
Well, long story short, if we incorporate historical sea level trends into our models, we'd probably have higher projections today. Let me put it this way. About 18,000 years ago, the planet was experiencing its last ice age. Sea level was about 420 feet below our present level because water was taken up by large continental ice sheets.
And as ice started melting, sea levels started rising, but it was not a gradual acceleration like we use in the models today. Instead, it was a series of very rapid pulses of sea level rise followed by pauses. When the climate warms, the large continental ice sheets don't gradually melt like an ice cube on a hot summer day. Instead, a certain ice sheet sector is destabilized, which then melts quickly and results in a rapid pulse of global sea level rise.
But there are still uncertainties about the rate at which ice sheets will melt and sea level will rise. Although our technology confidently suggests that sea levels will indeed rise, we can't be sure how quickly the cast of Jersey Shore will need to scurry inland.
But you're saying that in the past, these pulses of sea level rise, from 3 to 30 feet within a century, were fast enough to leave drowned reefs, sandy barrier islands, and other coastal deposits abandoned? And this could happen to my home? Well, okay, at least there aren't any other factors our current projection models fail to take into account, right?
Well, I mean, I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but there are other factors we need to start incorporating into our predictions. So we know that our warming climate is resulting in faster ice melt of the Greenland ice sheet. But much of this melted ice surface is darkening as dust and carbon, once stuck within the ice, now become concentrated on the surface.
Oh no, I see where this is going.
Yep, and as you might have guessed, this accelerates heat absorption, which in turn accelerates surface ice melt. At the same time, this meltwater trickles down through the ice cracks, resulting in significant fracturing of the pack ice.
And let me guess, this ice melt must then warm the rest of the ice until it's soft and can melt even quicker?
Not to mention that the quickly melting Arctic Ocean pack ice and the warmed ocean around it are releasing additional carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere. You might recall that both CO2 and methane are greenhouse gases, which trap heat from the sun closer to the Earth's surface and contribute to temperature increases. Sounds like a mean cycle we're trapped in.
So, if I'm hearing you right, basically what you're saying is that we're seeing the beginning of a rapid pulse of sea level rise. You really are the bearer of bad news, aren't you, Aubrey?
Hold on, Cleo. I might win the title after this one. Warmed ocean water is accelerating ice melt, not just within the Arctic pack, but also in both polar regions. Warm ocean water is now penetrating deep into fjords, under outlet glaciers and ice sheets of both West and East Antarctica, causing a significant amount of melting.
All right, I've heard enough. You win. Can we get some new co-hosts over here?
Oh, God.
Or is someone going to be the bearer of good news and tell me that there are things we can do about this sticky situation we're finding ourselves in?
It's much more watery than sticky, Cleo. Get your adjectives right.
Yes, sorry. I wouldn't want to deviate from our puns or anything.
Well, according to Dr. Wanless, we probably should be anticipating at least 7 to 30 feet of global sea level rise by the end of the century, regardless of what actions we take to mitigate climate change. Even if we stopped burning fossil fuels tomorrow, the greenhouse gases currently in the atmosphere will keep warming the Earth for at least another 30 years.
Yeah, unfortunately, oceans have the ability to store heat for centuries, meaning ice will keep melting and sea levels will keep rising as this heat is slowly released.
So when we're talking about 4 to 6 foot rise by the end of the century, it doesn't mean that sea levels will necessarily stabilize when the year 2100 rolls around.
Unfortunately not, but why don't we start discussing what our presenter and debaters discussed as realistic mitigation measures? Even if it is too late to reverse the rising of sea levels, we can still adapt.
That is true. We can still collectively change the way we invest in our coastal infrastructures to prepare for future sea levels.
Well, now you two are going to think that I'm the bearer of bad news. I hate to break it to you guys, but investments don't seem to be changing. In fact, Jersey Coast focus on rebuilding post-Hurricane Sandy rather than reinvesting. And places like Miami and the rest of South Florida are experiencing building booms. Coastal communities are clearly not considering the challenges of maintaining coastal properties in light of what we've been talking about today.
Yeah, actually, there are already areas that will be unlivable and properties that will be unsellable within a 30-year mortgage cycle. So I guess we might want to rethink our plans of retiring on the beach, huh?
Well, considering that with just 2 more feet of sea level rise, most of the world's barrier islands will become abandoned and the people relocated, I'm sorry to say that you won't even have the choice to consider retirement on one of these islands.
Hey, I'm happy to retire on any beach. It doesn't have to be an island.
Well, if you are considering retiring in New Jersey's coasts, you might want to know that low-lying areas and coastal communities will become flooded more frequently and become all-around difficult places in which to live. These communities will lose their freshwater resources, have failing infrastructure, and face huge storm surges.
Yeah, Daniela, these communities could even face failing sewage treatment plants. Geez, we sound like reverse real estate agents. Hire the Forum Real Estate Services today. We'll tell you where not to live.
On the plus side, investing in property that is today considered inland may result in some beachfront property in another 50 years or so.
Wow.
Okay, you're right. Maybe we do need to start replanning investments in these vulnerable areas.
Maybe? According to debaters, communities should definitely begin planning, even if they choose to accept the 2012 NOAA projections of 4 to 6 feet within the century, rather than Dr. Wanless's scaled-up predictions.
Okay, so when you say planning, do you mean building levees and dikes?
And for those of you who are unaware, levees and dikes are embankments that are constructed to prevent a river or other water body from overflowing or flooding.
But these won't work for all areas. Although coastal infrastructure, such as levees and dikes, may temporarily protect New Jersey's coasts as well as others around the world, not all communities can consider living below sea level with levees and dikes. For example, Florida's limestone and sand substrate render the foundations as just too weak to support such embankments.
Okay, well, whatever planning processes do look like, debaters stress that community leaders need to be transparent and innovative in developing strategies to prepare for disasters.
Well, at this point, these planning processes need to focus on realistic plans to keep communities stable during relocation and to protect the coastal environment after inundation by removing abandoned infrastructure and restoring ecosystems.
Okay, well, this is a bit difficult to hear, but I guess it's important to accept. So how can we help the communities around here adapt? What should they be doing?
Well, for one thing, the debaters suggested developing and using elevation maps to help communities determine timing and costs for maintaining their infrastructure.
And if these maps are consistently produced and updated as sea levels rise, they can help communities plan intelligently and decide which infrastructure can stay and which infrastructure is at too high of a risk and needs to be abandoned.
Wait, guys, what are elevation maps?
Oh, they're just maps of a certain area that show the elevation, storm surge, and flood risks in a given area. I'm sure you can see how they would be pretty useful in planning tools.
Okay. Well, this whole conversation is making Aubrey and me a bit nervous sitting around here in New Jersey and Florida while you're in Switzerland. So, considering the projections we have been talking about, how can we start adapting? Oh, say, tomorrow.
Well, for one thing, it's pretty clear to me that I can't retire on Florida's beaches now, because communities need to stop allowing for long-term developments on their low-lying coastlines.
We're not just talking about retirement communities, though. In fact, the people currently living near coastal regions will have to be relocated as sea levels continue to rise within the next century.
Whoa, wait. I certainly don't have the funds to just pick up and leave.
Settle down, Cleo. This relocation concept makes a lot of people nervous. That fact was clear at the debate. That's why, according to the debaters, public money should be reallocated from shore protection measures to assisting people that have to relocate.
But wait, we also need money to clean up our mess after we leave. We don't want our abandoned homes and infrastructure floating around the coastlines and continue to harm the ecosystems.
Good point. Debaters also supported the idea of using public funds for cleaning the low-lying polluted lands and removing damaged infrastructure that we'll be leaving behind.
But guys, usually after storms, these properties that you're talking about are just rebuilt. People don't usually leave one of our coastal communities after a big storm. They rebuild, as we saw in the Jersey coast after Hurricane Sandy.
This is probably not the best idea for the future. We need to establish some kind of threshold and system to determine whether a community should rebuild after a storm or accept that the area has just become too risky and relocate.
Well, I hate to break it to you, but I'm not so sure that you'll be able to easily convince communities to just up and leave places they've called home for who knows how long.
But there are so many risks, and rebuilding is so expensive. Actually, do people know that their money could be going towards continuous rebuilding as storm and flood risks increase?
Well, as a coastal resident, I certainly was not fully aware of all the projections and risks for our coast in the future. There are definitely community members that are skeptical or just plain in the dark about the realities of sea level rise.
Okay, so how about education? Would that help the public learn what's in store if adaptation measures aren't adopted?
Definitely. We need to initiate intensive education for the people that will be feeling the effects of these rising seas, including you and me.
Though we should mention that although we need to inform community members that sea levels are rising, the debaters did make a good point in that we need to be transparent about the uncertainties of the rate at which the rise will occur. In any case, providing this education will make community members more informed and also more supportive of why we should probably avoid the risks to begin with.
More informed, yes, but I wouldn't be so sure about more willing to relocate yet. We're still left with another problem. Even if people know their property might get damaged, insurance covers storm and flood damage, so people don't actually have to care about these costs.
Okay, so I understand now. The costs of rebuilding are not fully felt. Well, we need some kind of system to withdraw insurance protections so that people finally stop rebuilding on coasts and risking the impacts of sea level rise.
Such changes to insurance protection plans would definitely have to occur as a cooperative endeavor between the private and public sectors.
Yeah, well, debaters agreed that the public and private sectors are going to have to cooperate on much more than just insurance withdrawal when talking about sea levels rising in our coastal communities, which might not be the easiest.
True, we should be talking money here. Debaters seem to support the idea of framing the impacts of sea level rise in financial terms. Incentives and disincentives should be the drivers discouraging people from living in areas susceptible to the effects of sea level rise.
And there are already examples and associations to help communities get started in their planning and adaptation strategies.
That's right. Up in the Jersey area, the Town and Country Planning Association, commissioned by the Department of the Environment, published a plan called Future Proofing Jersey, Building Resilience for the 21st Century, in order to prepare for the growing challenges of sea level rise. And the New Jersey Climate Adaptation Alliance works with coastal communities in preparation as well.
Well, I'm glad that this conversation turned into steps we can take so I don't have to replace you two bearers of bad news with new co-hosts.
Yep, and communities might want to consider adopting similar plans because if we don't start planning now, we can probably kiss all of our favorite vacation destinations goodbye.
Not to mention, it'd be pretty rough for long-term residents as well. Just saying. But anyway, we should probably wrap things up so Aubrey and I can go enjoy these vacation destinations while we can still call them home.
Well, it's your turn to weigh in on social media. We're looking forward to seeing what you thought of today's episode. Is it time for coastal governments to start taking sea level rise more seriously and limiting development? Do coastal communities need to start thinking about relocation?
Should funding priorities shift from post-disaster rebuilding to preventive measures? Should insurance programs start withdrawing from coastal infrastructure to prevent rebuilding in risky zones?
Tweet us your thoughts using the hashtag ISGPForum, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at ISGPForum.
Don't forget to like us on Facebook as well.
Thanks for joining us here at the Institute on Science for Global Policy today. Hope you enjoyed socializing with science, and we'll catch you next time, right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.